Hello, this is Aaron, and welcome to the show today. This is a very exciting show for me personally, because I'm very happy to be joined by Dr. Brad Vermeulen. He is a sociologist at the University of Texas at Austin and the author of a new and very important new book called Reformed Resurgence, The New Calvinism and the Battle Over American Evangelicalism. So, Brad, thanks for joining. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, it really is. I'm not just saying that because you agreed to join the show. I mean, this is really a very important book. Maybe, is it the first scholarly treatment of New Calvinism?
Yeah, so.
I mean, it really is. I've seen some journalistic accounts, and this is really a, you know, very thorough and comprehensive overview. And I know I've sold you at least one book, because when I sent out the promotion of this event we're going to be doing, somebody wrote back and said, "Oh, I went ahead and bought it. That looks like a great book." So hopefully we'll sell a lot more. So thanks again for joining. Before we get in, I'll just tell the audience that if you have not already, please hit the subscribe button on YouTube. I appreciate that. And if you want to get on my newsletter, just go to themasculinist.com and sign up. So the first thing I just want to ask is, how did you get interested in sociology?
Yeah, I came to sociology actually in undergrad, in college at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. I knew as a freshman in undergrad that I wanted to study religion and culture and ideas, but I wasn't sure which discipline to do that through. I feel like if the University of Michigan had a religious studies major, I probably would have chosen that at the time, but they didn't, and I don't think they do still. So I took courses in psychology, and sociology. I ended up taking all those different disciplines and thinking about how I would study religion and culture and ideas through those different lenses. And it just struck me that sociology was probably the way I wanted to go, kind of the best discipline, the best lens through which the type of work I wanted to do, I could do. At the time, I was, you know, paying attention to something called the emerging church conversation. And I was into heady ideas about postmodernism and Christianity in the United States. And so it was really after I took my first intro to sociology class, I realized that the social sciences, rather than say philosophy or something like that, or history, would be the way to go for me.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that when you were going into undergrad, you knew what you wanted to study, which is, well, I had no clue what I wanted to do in my life when I went in there. Did you come from a religious background, or what's the interest in religion? How did that emerge?
I didn't know. I was raised in a secular household, but I became a Christian at the age of 15. So I was only a few years into my own journey as a Christian when I went off to college at a large public secular university. And so I kept pursuing that interest and knew I wanted to study religion somehow. And sociology seemed like the right course to do it.
So you did your PhD at Notre Dame?
That's right. Yeah, I did 4 years at Michigan for undergrad, and then I went straight from undergrad to grad school at Notre Dame. That was in 2008. So I did my master's and PhD at Notre Dame, both in sociology.
And then you studied under Christian Smith?
That's right. Yeah, he was, at the time, he was the director of their Center for the Study of Religion and Society, which is kind of a part of their sociology department there. So that was my institutional home. Why I was at Notre Dame was that center. It's a great research center for studying religion, all types of religion.
Yeah, I mean, I know him as being one of the co-inventors of the moralistic therapeutic deism concept that gets a lot of play. So it's rare when somebody tells me who their dissertation advisor was that I actually know who that is. But that's somebody who's like, that's like a big name. He's like a big name. So you're studying with, like, you know, serious people. So you were, that's a Catholic school. Are you Catholic or?
Not in the sense that most people mean it. No.
Okay.
I am a traditional Christian, somewhere between Presbyterian and Catholic. I try to take seriously the, you know, whole 2000 year history of the Christian church. And so that's where I am.
Okay. And your book is published by Oxford University Press. How does it feel to be published on a very prestigious imprint like that?
Yeah, that was the goal all along. A lot of Christian Smith's books are published by Oxford, so he set a good example for me of, you know, the type of end product I was looking for. So I knew setting out at the beginning of the project in 2012 that this was, I wanted it to be published as a book and probably with Oxford. And that's what happened in the end.
Yeah, not everybody gets their dissertation ultimately published as a book. So this was based on your dissertation. And so do you have like an estimate of like what share of dissertations actually get published as books?
I don't know. I would imagine it's very few in sociology, yeah. Although a lot of them, you know, get chopped up into articles. So somebody might get 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 peer-reviewed articles in separate journals, you know, out of their dissertation research. That's the ideal. But I think it's less common to have a whole dissertation be published as a book.
Hmm. So is this book, was it peer-reviewed?
Yep.
Is that part of like, okay, yeah. Because I think a lot of the academic books have to be peer-reviewed to even go through the process. And it is an academic book, but I think I want to make sure everybody knows is this is very readable work. It's not one of these sociology, there's numbers in it, but it's not one of these sociology studies that's all a bunch of statistical analysis that's very hard to interpret. I mean, it's really very, very narratively driven. I'll say it's written in plain English. Maybe that's a demerit in the academic world. I don't know, but certainly the people who will buy your book will appreciate it.
Yeah, I mean, I've always been kind of a plain English type writer, and I that ended up in the book being fairly clear, I hope. I mean, it does get a little dense in parts, and it's probably not for everybody, but it's readable.
Your book's called Reformed Resurgence, so it's about Reformed theology. So for people who don't know, what is Reformed theology?
Yeah, that's a little bit of a contested issue between, you know, Baptists and people who are called truly Reformed. But basically, the way I use it in the book is as synonymous with Calvinism. That will bother some people because some people say that to be Reformed, you have to be, you know, connected to a historic Reformed denomination. You have to believe in infant baptism, covenant theology, and that type of thing. Like Westminster theology types, they would be truly Reformed. But I use Reformed in a slightly looser way, in the sense that Baptists and maybe even non-denominational Christians could be Reformed as well, in the sense that they're Calvinistic. So Calvinistic being essentially John Calvin's view of soteriology, his doctrine of salvation being predestination, the idea that essentially God is sovereign over who is saved and who is not saved. There's, you know, the 5 points of Calvinism, which is commonly summarized using the acronym TULIP, total depravity, unconditional election, limited atonement, irresistible grace, and perseverance of the saints. And those are 5 doctrines that really summarize John Calvin's view of Christian salvation. And that's distinct from, you know, Lutheran views, Wesleyan views, Catholic views, a host of other views. But it's essentially the idea of predestination, God determined before the foundations of the world whether or not you would be saved. That one big thing is that the cross, the idea is that when Jesus died on the cross, one's salvation was secured in that moment and didn't just open up a door of possibilities that one might later accept, that type of thing.
Mm-hmm. So what is new Calvinism?
Right, so Calvinism has been around since John Calvin, 500 years, and a lot of Calvinists would argue that it goes back before John Calvin a long time. But the new on new Calvinism essentially is to represent that this is a kind of a new generation of Calvinists in American Christianity. I say in the book that it's not new in the sense that it's some serious alteration or revision of Calvinism. That's not what these religious leaders are up to. It's a resurgence of Calvinism among a new generation of American Christians. So it's especially after the turn of the millennium. So new Calvinism basically just being a prominence of Calvinism on the scene again in American Christianity. And I do distinguish between new Calvinism and something that's called neo-Calvinism, which that term was already used to refer to kind of the Abraham Kuyper type Calvinists in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, and still around today. So neo-Calvinism is a phrase used that I describe as kind of being, you know, explicitly Kuyperian, Abraham Kuyper.
Dutch Reform, former prime minister of the Netherlands.
Yeah. So new Calvinism is like that, but it's a different social and religious phenomenon in the sense that it really emerged on the scene in the last, 20 years.
Who are examples of people who would fall into the new Calvinism camp?
Yeah, as with any social phenomenon, it's, it can be contested who's in and who's out, but there's a center of gravity for sure. And that really wasn't determined by me. That was determined by journalists, especially Colin Hanson, who came before me and pointed out, hey, these are the new Calvinists. And that would include, churches like Mars Hill Church in Seattle, which no longer exists, and their longtime pastor, Mark Driscoll, John Piper at Bethlehem Baptist Church in Minneapolis. Tim Keller wasn't included in Colin Hanson's book, but I think it's fair to say, more than fair to say, that Tim Keller is involved in this Orbit Redeemer Presbyterian Church in New York City. It would include the Gospel Coalition, which Tim Keller was the president of. The Acts 29 Church Planting Network, which kind of got its DNA and ethos from Mark Driscoll and Mars Hill. I would include Mark Dever at Capitol Hill Baptist Church in Washington, D.C., his ministry, Nine Marks. James McDonald and his Harvest mega church in the Chicagoland area I would include in the new Calvinism, even though he's had a downfall in recent years. Colin Hanson, the guy who wrote, originally back in 2006 and 2008 about the new Calvinists, he's, now... directing a lot of things at the Gospel Coalition. So he's in there. And there's a lot of others too. I can go on and on. I have a whole chapter just spelling out all these actors. It's various religious leaders, especially pastors and seminary professors. So Wayne Grudem, for example, would be a seminary professor. But also, organizations, mega churches, councils, conferences, so the Council for Biblical Manhood and Womanhood, John Piper and Wayne Grudem were essential in creating that several years ago. Together for the Gospel is a big conference that happens every 2 years that would be in this, and others. So there's a lot.
Yeah. So these groups are all sort of connected with each other, right? So it is sort of a movement, if somewhat loosely affiliated movement in some respects.
Yeah, it's loosely affiliated. I call it a cluster. It's a cluster of religious leaders and organizations and councils and conferences that are identifiable as they're all Calvinists. They're all complementarian on the question of gender and female clergy. They're all, fairly conservative, if not very conservative, on social issues. And they, will endorse each other's books and speak at conferences together and that type of thing. So they're friendly with each other, less so in the last couple of years, I think. But it's an identifiable cluster of religious leaders and organizations in American evangelicalism.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever heard the terms Big Eva or the Gospel Industrial Complex?
I have, yes.
Yeah.
After I finished my PhD, so the book was finished, 80% of the book was finished in 2016. So after that, that's when I heard the term Big Eva. My sense is that's kind of a critical term from the more very conservative Protestants who are critical of, the big show of kind of the big players in American evangelicalism.
Yeah. I want to put up something on the screen here. One of these guys actually put together a chart that they call the Gospel Industrial Complex. I don't know if you can see that. And it includes a lot of the names that you listed on there. Maybe you haven't studied this, but do you feel that what's labeled here as the Gospel Industrial Complex or Big Eva is sort of coterminous with New Calvinism, or... Is that
The Gospel Industrial Complex isn't a term that I would use.
Yeah. It's a polemical term, obviously.
Yeah, because it's a polemical term. But if I'm looking at just the actors and the organizations and conferences listed here, then yeah, this is exactly what I'm talking about. You got Desiring God, that's John Piper's ministry. RTS, I would say that's kind of a little bit more truly Reformed and just kind of there as a Calvinist organization or a Reformed organization. It might not be New Calvinist in the sense that it's connected to the world of Piper, Driscoll, that world. Same with like Westminster Seminary and the one in California too. Those feel a little more established, kind of old Calvinist, I guess. So I don't know if RTS would be in it, but Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and Al Mohler definitely would. I mentioned them in the book, so yes.
Yeah, you know, I find it, I mean, obviously I put that up there because people see this as a group, not just their friends or themselves, but kind of even their opponents sort of view this cluster, this constellation of people as if they're a thing, right? So I think you're on to something with that. You visited a few of those churches and did sort of, you know, deep field research on them. Which ones did you visit again?
Right. So for dissertation in sociology, you have to gather empirical data. Typically, some people write theory dissertations, but that's very rare. So my data was all qualitative data, and it was data of three types. The first is participant observation, where I go places and I hang out with people and I, you know, observe and participate in all sorts of things. So what I did with that mostly was three mega churches, Mars Hill Church in Seattle, Driscoll, Bethlehem Baptist Church with Piper, and Redeemer Presbyterian Church in New York City with Tim Keller. I also have a few other conferences and things like that that I attended for the participant observation portion of the data. I complemented that with 75 interviews with mostly with evangelical leaders. Some of them were, I wouldn't really say evangelical leaders. They were the tech guy at Mars Hill or something like that. But 75 interviews, people who were both inside, so to speak, the New Calvinism, but also people who are definitively outside and critical of the New Calvinism, but still within the orbit of evangelicalism. And the third portion was content analysis of both printed and online content. So printed being, I gathered all sorts of pamphlets and orders of worship from these churches I attended, but also books published, by evangelical presses that I read. And of course, deep dive into the digital world of American evangelicalism, which any, you know, it's all online, easy to do. So from the fall of 2012 through 2016, I was just deeply, deeply immersed for research purposes into this kind of digital world of American evangelicalism. So those were the three, you know, kinds of data. They're all qualitative data.
And I'm assuming these churches all knew you were there.
Eventually, yeah. So funny thing is with each one, actually, I emailed them ahead of time saying, hey, I'm a PhD student in sociology trying to write this dissertation on this. Here's what it's about. Can I come study your church? And I don't think any of them agreed to it at first, but I went anyways. And, I started out with, first I did Mars Hill, and then second was, which one did I do? I think it was Redeemer, and then Bethlehem. I may be wrong. It's been a long a few years, but I flew out to each of those three without any agreement from the churches that they were going to be participating in the project. But it didn't take long for me to get to know some of the pastors, let them know what I was doing there. And eventually they all were just like, okay, yeah, you can interview me for the project. And so I ended up doing interviews with a lot of the pastoral staff and other leaders in those three mega churches. Unfortunately, I was unable to pin down Mark Driscoll or Don Piper for an interview, although I was able to interview Tim Keller. And I was able to have some, you know, casual conversations with Mark Driscoll when I was in Seattle, but never able to sit down and do a formal interview with him. Mm-hmm. All three churches were aware of what I was doing within, 3 weeks of me being there. Hmm. I didn't hide anything.
Mm-hmm. So you're meeting people and you're telling them I'm a sociologist. How are they reacting to this? I'm just wondering how, like, the average person, if you meet someone doing a study, as like, you know, the field research part of it to me is very fascinating. Like, how do you go out and do data with other people when they kind of like know, do they know they're being part of this? Or
yeah, I mean, that, my project wasn't about ordinary congregants, so I had mm-hmm. very little interest in studying or interviewing ordinary congregants, and so a lot of them, they're, you know, it didn't really matter to them. So I would let them know, yeah, I'm here for 2 months. I'm writing a research project on the church. And some of them would be like, okay, that's, you know, and not really care. Others would ask a few questions about it. And I actually used, whenever I was in those types of situations and people were asking me about my research, I took that as an opportunity to, you know, gather more data essentially. And I asked them, you know, they said, well, what's your research project about? And I would say, do you know what Calvinism is? And about a quarter of the time, the answer was no. And that factoid ended up in the book.
Yeah, I was so, really, I saw that. In fact, it was on my list to ask you about later on. It was pretty amazing to me that these self-consciously Calvinist churches, you know, a sizable number of their congregants don't even know what Calvinism is.
A minority, but yeah.
Yeah.
But when it came to the pastoral staff and other leaders of the churches, I had a couple who kind of brushed me off, but it was broadly welcoming, and they, it took some effort, some emails, some meeting, like one or two, and like, hey, can you introduce me to this guy, that type of thing. But it wasn't really that hard to get into the highest levels of leadership of these three megachurches. Eventually, for example, my last 2 days in Seattle, they gave me a guided tour behind the scenes of the entire church, the main building. They let me shadow them for a work day to see how they produce their music and their videos and their all sorts of things. So yeah, like, it was,
that's great,
broadly welcoming. I do mention in the book in an appendix about how, you know, other people may not have had as easy of a time as I did if they were, you know, look different from me, or, you know, in a wheelchair or whatever, and had different things going on than I do. But so I think being who I am and kind of made it a little easier than could have been for other people, just mm-hmm. to be fair. But yeah.
So when did the new Calvinism start? Where did it kind of emerge from?
So there's two ways to answer that. So when did it start versus when did it become a thing? So when did it become,
tell me about both.
Yeah, when did it become a thing? I would say sometime between 2006 and 2008. Those are the years that Colin Hanson, so in 2006, he wrote a big article in Christianity Today about this kind of Calvinist phenomenon, saying that it's kind of, you know, resurging back on the scene. And the same guy, Colin Hanson, 2 years later, came out with a book-length treatment of the topic called Young, Restless, Reformed, published by Crossway. And that kind of put the movement kind of on the map of a lot of religion observers in the United States. So I would say that's when the new Calvinism became a thing, was strongly through the work of Colin Hanson in 2006 and 2008. But where did it come from, or when did it start? I would say all the actors were in place in 2006 for Colin Hanson to observe. And so it started before that, right? So the X29 network, I think, started in 1997 or 1998. Mars Hill Church in Seattle was started in 1996. And I think the Desiring God started as a tape ministry in 1994. So, and there's longer, much longer, roots even than that, you know. So R.C. Sproul, for example, was doing ministry in the 70s, 80s. So there are long roots, so to speak, decades, you know, in 70s and 80s, and then especially things started to take off in the 90s. But it became a thing, really, in 2006 through 2008. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that Young, Restless, and Reformed label really did seem to stick. I just read an article by Kevin DeYoung, who's part of this group, and he was referencing that label even today. I guess just the mere fact of giving something a name sometimes draws people to identify with it.
Very much.
And you know, you mentioned he was sort of in the movement, and Crossway is sort of like their house publisher, and so there's sort of a, you know, some things there. Where does New Calvinism fit in with evangelical more broadly?
Right. It's definitely a minority segment of American evangelicalism. For people who pay attention to the movement, it may seem like the biggest thing, or, you know, the whole thing, but it's not. There is a broader evangelical landscape that includes what I call mainstream evangelicals, and other groups too. So, like, there's neo-Anabaptist evangelicals who hang around the Missio Alliance and read David Fitch, for example, or Greg Boyd. And there's progressive evangelicals, people, you know, like Rachel Held Evans or Rob Bell, that type of crowd, who resemble mainline liberal Protestants in some ways, but kind of are in the, or were, Rachel has passed, but in the evangelical orbit. So there's, if I had to guess, and it's only a guess, I would say that the New Calvinism constitutes maybe only 5 to 15% of American evangelicalism. It's largely a college-educated movement, and most American evangelicals are college-educated, for example. So you have to look at Middle America, the broad landscape. There's over 1,000 evangelical megachurches in the United States. So there's a lot going on. The evangelical world is a lot bigger than a lot of people see or notice. So it's definitely a minority of American evangelicalism.
You mentioned in the book that, you know, kind of this emerging church, you talked about earlier in this conversation, the emerging church movement kind of came out at the same time. And then it seems to me like the neo-Anabaptist movement also kind of got big about the same time. What was going on in the evangelical world that sort of created, that caused some of these different little tribes or groups to start crystallizing or developing around the same time?
Right. So the short answer is, in the mid to late 90s, attention to postmodernist philosophy and how Christians should respond to it. So the emerging church conversation really took off in the mid to late 90s. Especially 1997, 1998, about how evangelical Protestants should respond to postmodernism as a thought framework and postmodernity as a socio-cultural condition. And so from the late 90s through 2000, you know, 5, 6, 7, it was the biggest thing on the American evangelical landscape, as far as I could tell, was how should we think about postmodern philosophy and the postmodern condition? They would define those things, you know. And there were different answers to those questions. Mark Driscoll and Mars Hill Church were a part of that conversation for a while, and they were pretty much uninterested in revising theology and ethics, but they were more open to revising, you know, how things are done in church and that type of thing. And so that's, you know, one answer to the emerging church conversation. Others were eager to revise theology and ethics and became what I call the emergent or progressive stream of American evangelicalism. So that would include people like I mentioned, Rob Bell, Brian McLaren, Tony Jones, Doug Padgett, Rachel Held Evans, and several others. Another thing that would come out of the emerging church conversation was kind of this neat new monastic tendency trend in American evangelicalism. You can think of someone like Shane Claiborne living in holistic communities, intentional communities across the country. And that's one expression of a bigger neo-Anabaptist kind of pocket of American evangelicalism who kind of take their cues from the Mennonites and other peace churches, but with a strong evangelical bent to them. So in the book, I say that the emerging church conversation from the late 90s through about 2005 served as a sifter of sorts to create and fortify what are currently the major expressions or pockets of American evangelicalism. So everybody kind of squeezed through the emerging church conversation and came out on the other side, either as a progressive emergent or kind of a neo-Anabaptist with maybe some intentional community angles, or you ended up, you know, a Calvinist. And some, and then there's still this huge infrastructural backdrop of mainstream evangelicalism that you can't ignore.
You mentioned when you went to undergrad, you said some interest in the emerging church movement. And I'm wondering what motivated you to pick the new Calvinist movement versus some of those, you know, new, maybe the neo-Anabaptist or the emerging church movement to do your dissertation.
Right. So I knew somebody was already working on a book about the new monastic movement with the Shane Claiborne types. And that was published as a book with Oxford University Press in 2015. It's a great book that actually uses a similar theoretical framework as mine does, by Wes Markovsky. He got his PhD in sociology as well. So I knew I didn't want to write a book on the new monastic movement. That was taken. There are already people writing books on the progressive side of American evangelicalism, and as that was linked to the emerging church conversation. Gerardo Marty has a book, The Deconstructed Church, also published by Oxford, which is a great treatment of that. But nobody was really writing a scholarly treatment of this Calvinist phenomenon, and it had been something I'd been paying attention to on the internet for a few years, and it struck me as something that I could tackle really well. So that's what I took up.
This 2006 to 2008 period, where you say the new Calvinism really became a thing, is really also when essentially, Internet 2.0 became a thing, right? I mean, I think the iPhone came out about that time, and this is really when sort of the rise of social media really started to take off. What is the role of the internet in the rise of new Calvinism?
Yeah, I think the new Calvinism is at least as much an online religious movement as it is a flesh and blood religious movement. You have people, you know, following Mars Hill's sermons every week, or in that period as well. I think it was 2007 that the Gospel Coalition launched, and they have a you know, behemoth of a website. So the internet and other sorts of digital media provide young evangelicals kind of the portal to this whole world, this whole religious world, where they can watch sermons, listen to podcasts, read articles on the Gospel Coalition or Nine Marks or Desiring God. They all have their websites, and you know, it's huge, especially for people under 40. It's an outsized reality, to borrow a phrase from the book. The internet is an outsized reality for younger people, not just Christians. So it's, I don't think the new Calvinism really would have coalesced as a thing if it wasn't for the internet, among other things.
Well, it's certainly great for distribution. I mean, I never would have heard, I would have been stuck in a tape ministry, I guess, other than listening. I mean, I personally listened to probably 100 Mark Driscoll sermons back in the 2012-2013 timeframe. And I was watching a lot of these sermons online. I watched a lot of John Piper sermons. And so the internet lets you essentially go to church, if you will, anywhere in the country you want now, because you can just download their stuff.
That's right. You can have an eye on all sorts of mega churches and pastors, and you can even get a sense of like what it might feel like to be at their services. Even, you know, you can't really get it fully, but you can get a sense of what it might feel like, and how they preach. Definitely the internet is and was huge for the movement. Unfortunately, I was only able to dedicate, you know, I don't know, 3 or 4 pages in the book to it, but I tried to strike that note strongly and say it would have been impossible without the internet.
The main analytical framework you use for looking at New Calvinism was something called strategic action field theory. Is there a way to like give like a distilled explanation of what that is?
I'll try, sure. So people talk all the time about, you know, I work in this field, I work in that field. You know, the field might be publishing or education, right? So in sociology and other social sciences, field theory is something tapping into that, but it's something specific, and it's looking at arenas of human life, arena, like a kind of a sphere or an arena or field, right? It's kind of this space, this social space that you can kind of identify. So there are different types of field theory. It gets messy really quick. But field theory essentially is looking at different spheres or domains of human life. One of them would be, so they can be nested too. So you can have like the religious field. I work in the religious field, or, you know, the religious sphere. But then you can have subfields within that. So I would say American evangelicalism is a subfield within the broader field of American religion, for example. So there's at least three different flavors, expressions of field theory that I won't get into, but the one that I use is called strategic action fields. So it places more of an emphasis on conflict and strategic positioning of people in these fields than do the other expressions of field theory. So I hope I'm making sense, but you have actors in these fields. They could be individual people or organizations. And they're trying to position themselves to essentially move to a more advantageous position in the field for esteem or, various types of reward in the field. And it's a battle. There's conflict with other actors in the field. There's contestation. And it's possible for these actors to, you know, enact strategies to move to a more advantageous position in their field. And that's essentially a certain type of field theory. There's also, not everybody in the field is in an equal positioning, right? So there is what's called incumbents, and those are people who tend to be the more powerful players in the field. And then there's challengers, so up-and-comers, who are trying to, this would be the, in the evangelical field, this would be things like, you know, the neo-Anabaptists or the progressives, who are kind of the underdogs, so to speak. So there's incumbents and challengers in a field, vying with each other for advantage, using various strategies. And that, in brief, that's strategic action field theory.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that came to mind when I was reading about it is like one of these strategic board games where you've got, you know, multiple players, and there's this board, which is your field, and they're all trying to move their pieces around and gain the high ground and gain the strategic points. And essentially, the goal is to, in essence, dominate the field. And to have your sort of views predominate.
Yep.
Yeah. One of the things that you say is that this field, this evangelical field, is a site of contestation over symbolic power. And I'll just read like one quote I had here. It says, "And it is such symbolic power, the power to impose on others a legitimate vision of the social world and its groupings, that allows for power in and over any given field." What is this this idea of symbolic power?
Right. I take that from a French sociologist, very popular in my field, sociology, Pierre Bourdieu. So symbolic power, in order to understand it, first you have to understand what it's built upon, and that's something called symbolic capital. Capital is basically a resource, right? So just like you can have economic capital or social capital, who you know, your friends or your networks, you can also have symbolic capital. And that essentially is recognition or esteem or clout, basically. And if you have that recognition, esteem, clout, symbolic capital in your field, on top of that, you can build essentially symbolic power. You can see how that might necessitate symbolic capital, right? So symbolic power is not really, I mean, there's different types of power. It's not like, it's not necessarily like physical power or economic power, although it can be economic or coercive power, but it's a symbolic power to essentially make things happen in your field with your words. That's what Pierre Bourdieu talks about. Your words have power in your field. So that's, in short, that's what symbolic power is. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, I thought a lot about James Davison Hunter and cultural change and the idea that there are these entities that contain that have sort of cultural power, like the New York Times has a lot of cultural power, maybe symbolic power, and that what the New York Times writes defines reality for a lot of people.
Yep, that would be a good example of, you know, the New York Times has symbolic power over the field of publishing or news journalism. So that would be an example. An example I like to use that I use in the book, I think, is that like a university administrator has the symbolic power to say who's on the honor roll. People actually are, you know, out there getting good grades, but you're not really on the honor roll until an administrator, you know, puts out the list or something like that, and that they have created a grouping with their words, essentially. So because they have the legitimate power to create such a thing. So when John Piper says farewell, Rob Bell, on Twitter, when John Piper says farewell, Rob Bell on Twitter, he's essentially, he probably isn't recognizing that he's doing this, but that's an enactment of symbolic power to do something with your words, something powerful to essentially expel him from the ranks of the evangelicals.
Yeah, so relative to symbolic power, you know a lot of the different strategies and things that they do. And so I want to throw out a few and just get your reaction to them. One of them is the role of celebrity. What was the role of celebrity?
Yeah. I present it in the book more about charismatic authority than celebrity, right? But they're related, obviously. So a lot of this is the phenomenon of celebrity pastors, especially in the evangelical world. I think anybody who's familiar with evangelical Christianity knows there's big name pastors, John Piper, Tim Keller, Mark Driscoll, Matt Chandler, that type of thing, who are, at least them in the Calvinist world, you know, celebrity pastors. There's others who aren't, you know, Calvinists. So like Joel Osteen would be a kind of celebrity pastor among the prosperity crowd. You know, Rob Bell was a celebrity pastor among more progressive evangelicals, for example. So it's you can't really explain the new Calvinism without taking that into account somehow. And the way I describe it is as kind of having this charismatic authority that attracts followers. And this kind of, it's hard to explain charisma, obviously, but it's this kind of polished, attractive way that leaders can carry themselves and present themselves and give talks, and it draws people in. And that's a big, that's one big factor in this movement.
Yeah, it strikes me that when sort of the Gospel Coalition, these guys were founded, many of these new Calvinist leading lights were already big name people with huge churches. And they'd essentially carved out, essentially individual celebrity at some level. Many of them maybe became most famous after that. But they were certainly well known, and had made large followings, and it was almost like it's the all-star team. It's like we're all kind of like big name people. We're going to get together with other big name people and create like a network.
Yeah, there was definitely some of that going on. I mean, and there were other big name people who they excluded. You know, a good example would be like I just mentioned, Rob Bell or Joel Osteen, and there's others who don't fit theologically with this cluster of people. Mm-hmm. So it was a teaming up of sorts of, I mean, that's why the Gospel Coalition was formed in 2007, in part as a reaction against the emerging church conversation. So you had these people, you know, forming a coalition to define certain theological and ethical issues.
Mm-hmm. What about the role of New Calvinism as a gatekeeping entity?
Right. So there's several ways that the new Calvinist leaders position themselves strategically in the field. You know, I can get into all, you know, 8 or 10 of them if you want to. But one of them is as gatekeepers of theological orthodoxy. Not all. I think some have more of a tendency toward this than others. So, for example, Denny Burke at Southern Baptist Theological Seminary or Al Mohler have a stronger tendency toward this than someone like, say, Tim Keller, who's kind of just more go along, get along, kind of. So there's gatekeeping, there's boundary drawing against other actors in the evangelical field when they do things that are out of bounds, so to speak. So some examples I get into would be Rob Bell's big thing with his book Love Wins, where he was questioning the reality of hell, or at least what he was perceived to be. And there was that huge online pushback at, you know, against Rob Bell and hell. So, and there were, of course, blog posts written and books written about, you know, why evangelicals need to believe in a certain theology of hell. So that'd be one, you know, boundary drawing and gatekeeping. And Rob Bell essentially was expelled from the evangelical fold, functionally speaking, after that. Went on tour with Oprah, I believe, shortly thereafter. Another example that I get into is when World Vision, it's at least its U.S. branch, changed its employee conduct policy temporarily, it turned out, to include employees who were in gay and lesbian relationships, who were married, so to speak. So there was a huge online pushback from New Calvinists, but also others like Franklin Graham, who I wouldn't count in this group. And less than 48 hours after the announcement after the change was announced, they reversed it in light of two things, as far as I can tell: the huge online pushback from evangelical leaders and the dropping of thousands of endorsements of children in light of that policy change. So that would be a gatekeeping, where basically a large mainstream evangelical organization does something and then lots of other actors say, you can't do that, you shouldn't do that, you really need to reverse that. And they did, in less than 2 days. So those are just a couple examples of gatekeeping. I think Rachel Held Evans got a lot of gatekeeping directed at her, basically people saying, you're not really an evangelical for various reasons. And eventually she self-selected out and became Episcopalian.
Hmm. Well, you know, I thought it was really interesting. I don't know if you heard it. 2 or 3 weeks ago, Tim Keller had a podcast. I think it was with Colin and with Kevin DeYoung and some people from Crossway, where they reflected a little bit on your book, and he's sort of like, yeah, I guess we were celebrities. I guess we were gatekeepers. So I think it was sort of like, he's like, he kind of owned it there a little bit, that there was sort of a gatekeeping function. I think a lot of the critics, you know, kind of a lot of the maybe truly reformed or other critics of these guys from within Calvinism sort of treat them as gatekeepers, in that they argue, if you don't play ball with these guys, you're never going to be invited to any of the big conferences. You're sort of going to get frozen out. So they've, you know, essentially these are the guys you got to play ball with if you want to, you know, have a rep in this field. You know, I've never tried to speak at any other conferences, so I wouldn't know if that how accurate that is. But I know that's the complaint of, you know, I hear from people online.
Yeah, I see a lot of complaining from especially neo-Anabaptists and progressive, although the progressives are kind of aware that they're kind of just doing their own thing at this point. But a lot of the more kind of neo-Anabaptists and Peace Church-inspired evangelicals, you can see, if you look for it, you can see, like, you know, hey, why don't they dialogue with us or whatever? So why, you know, they want to be more kind of have a seat at the table of what you would call it, Big Eva, I guess. So there is one way to say it is that the religious leaders themselves are at least in large part aware of these dynamics that I'm explaining as well. So it's not just me shedding some new light on this. It's they know what's going on.
What was the role of the media? And that was another thing that you mentioned, the use of media.
Like newspapers.
Yeah. Like you mentioned them taking advantage of the press.
Yeah. So one thing, for example, was that, you know, they like to make a big deal out of the Time magazine article that was said that the new Calvinism was one of the top 10 ideas changing the world. That was probably in 2010 or 11. And they, you know, championed that for a week or two, and it still gets mentioned, you know. I think if you look at the other 9 things on the list, it's just kind of a quick time piece that there's 10 things you click on. It's little, you know, some ideas. It's amazing, in my view, the traction that the New Calvinist movement got from that short Time magazine reference. They championed it, and it was a huge thing. And they kind of, in a sense, they propelled themselves and made themselves indeed bigger and stronger by the media coverage. So the Time magazine article was huge, and later things came out too. A later expression was in the New York Times. Mark Oppenheimer wrote a piece that he interviewed me for about the movement. And I remember, you know, on the phone with them explaining this from, like, you know, by interviewing me, I'm deep in writing the book at this point, 2014. I said, you know, by the act of interviewing me and writing the story, we are helping to fortify the movement. He's like, oh, I never thought of it that way. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, this was the one area in the book that, to me, I may have even gone further than you on this one. Because it looks to me like these guys have very strategically cultivated relationships with the elite secular media as a very powerful, culturally powerful platforms for, asserting their control. I was really struck when you ran off a list of op-eds that people wrote during the Trump. But I didn't really talk about the politics of these guys, but you said that they were very never Trump. That they really didn't go for the religious right. And you sort of wheeled off a list of op-eds people wrote during a Trump campaign. And I just noted that they were in the New York Times, the Washington Post, ABC News, the Washington Post, CNN, the Gospel Coalition, the New Yorker, the New York Times, the Gospel Coalition, and Desiring God. That is a lot of super, super elite media that these guys have been able to get op-eds placed in. Or get quoted in. Earned media may even be better in some ways. That almost has to reflect, I would think, a strategic decision to try to penetrate those things rather than rely on the traditional Christian media.
Potentially, yeah. It's not something that, I mean, that was kind of an afterthought in the book because it needed to be added because it was, published last year in 2020 and something needed to be said about Trump. But part of me would say, yes, I understand what you're saying, and a part of me wants to point out that the Washington Post loves to hear from evangelicals who are coming from a certain angle, saying, strongly anti-Trump or something. So there is that sort of self-selection from the media itself.
Right.
So, yeah, I don't think Tim Keller has ever had trouble getting published in, something like The Atlantic or The New Yorker or something. He's a big name, and I think he deserves to be published in those types of outlets. So it's... But they do end up in good, high place, journalism. So.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that one of the things that they did to distinguish them is they really did not affiliate with the religious right. They were very apolitical, in a sense. But that you thought that, kind of under the hood, they probably were political conservatives. But they didn't market themselves that way. I'm just wondering if that's still kind of your point of view. Like, where do you think they stand politically today?
Right. So a lot of these new Calvinist leaders looked at the kind of moral majority Jerry Falwell expression of evangelicalism in years past, and they knew that was not the way to go. It was triumphalistic. It was kind of insecure in certain ways, and it was really a big turnoff for younger Christians. And so it was kind of a self-conscious move to be like, that's... And not to say it's disingenuous, it's just like, that's not what we're about. It's not what we're going to do. We're not, wedded to the Republican Party in the sense that Jared Falwell and the moral majority and the Christian Coalition and those types of actors were in the 70s and 80s. And they talk about this publicly. They articulate this for people to hear. And that can serve as a strategic discourse in the field to attract younger Christians and, to have this kind of non-triumphalistic public theology or something. So at the same time, they are conservative evangelicals. They're pro-life on, abortion. They're against redefining marriage to include gay and lesbian couples. They are, I think at least a few I can think of are vocally pro-death penalty. They're fiscal conservatives, that type of thing. So they're right-leaning for sure politically. So, but they do present themselves as nonpartisan, if that makes sense. So there's a little bit of a tightrope that they're walking there to lean strongly conservative, theologically, morally, and politically, but also to be nonpartisan, say, hey, we're not Republicans, you know, maybe they are, but they're not Republicans first, or, you know, they'd say they're Christians first. And to differentiate themselves from the religious right, Christian right of the 1980s. So that, I think that's a strategic thing they can do, and that they do to win a hearing, in a sense, among younger Christians.
There are a couple of figures in the book that are sort of related to you, but maybe a little bit distinct from this new Calvinist movement. So I wanted to get your take on where they fit in. You mentioned Douglas Wilson a couple of times in your book. Where does Doug Wilson fit in your schema?
Right. So if I remember correctly, he's a conservative traditional Presbyterian and kind of on the fringes of this movement. So he interacts a little bit with kind of the John Piper crowd. So what I tried to do in the book was to, the reader gets a sense, if somebody's in the peripheral in the book, then they're peripheral in the vision of the new Calvinists, if that makes sense. So if somebody's only mentioned in a footnote once or twice in the book, then, and you get the sense like this guy got mentioned, I wonder why, then that's kind of where he is in the field too, from the perspective of the new Calvinists. So Doug Wilson would be an example of that. He's not kind of new Calvinist in the sense that he's, you know, the new Calvinism is mostly a Baptist movement, Calvinistic Baptist, but Doug Wilson is a conservative Presbyterian, kind of a more hardline kind of, you know, vocal.
I'd say he's more traditional religious right, you know.
Yeah, I don't personally know a lot about him. I haven't immersed myself in his media, but yeah, he's, if you get the sense in the book that he's somebody I mentioned twice and he's kind of peripheral, that's I would say kind of intentional. I did the same thing with John MacArthur. Right.
That's the second guy I was going to ask you about. I mean, I know there's been some kerfuffles about John MacArthur and this statement on social justice. So there was maybe a guy who would have been more in is now more out.
Right. So I intentionally went into the book saying I'm not going to include, if I can say it, fundamentalists. Mm-hmm. That's not to say that John MacArthur would self-identify as a fundamentalist. I don't think he would. But he is, in my understanding of the field, kind of the transition point, I guess, between evangelicals and fundamentalists. So he's just a hair more mainstream than fundamentalists. So he's like he was the stopping point for me, if put it that way, theologically, and in terms of his theology and his tone and his boundary drawing and his whole thing. He was my stopping point to the right. So, and there's people, you can find people online saying, you know, John MacArthur is too liberal because he's speaking on stage with whoever. So you can go to the right a lot, but, so I stopped at John MacArthur and only mentioned him a couple times, because I wanted to focus on the evangelical field broadly and the new Calvinist role in it. And for me, once I started talking about John MacArthur, I was kind of leaving the field, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm.
Thinking about the future, you know, one of the things that you note in the book is how many of these big new Calvinist figures have suffered some sort of a fall or a scandal. You know, you mentioned Mars Hill Church, it doesn't even exist anymore. So you think Mark Driscoll, James McDonald, C.J. Mahaney, Joshua Harris, Darren Patrick, Tully Chavidian. You know, how does this movement, I mean, I keep asking, like, how many casualties can you take before your movement really starts to suffer from prominent people, you know, having these issues? Do you have a sense of that?
Right. And those names you listed off, that's exactly right. I don't know if people know, if your viewers will know the stories behind each of them, but it ranges from being fired from your mega church to suicide or, you know, leave. And also, I think, abandoning the Christian faith altogether. So in I think it's chapter two, where I'm describing the actors in this movement. There's a, I write out a lot of descriptions, and then at one point I just turn to bullet points, and then here's, you know, 15 more leaders or whatever it is who are active in this movement. And the thing is, I made that list in 2012 or 13. And I kept having to revise it with all these new, you know, troubles. But I thought it would be unfair for me to change that list. So I kept it the way it was. And that's, so what you end up with is people who you look at the list and you go, oh, wow, only, you know, less than, you know, fewer than half of these are still, you know, where they want to be. So it's something I noticed for sure was I intentionally did not change that list from what it was in 2013. Because just to be fair, you know, to reality. So, but yeah, there's the new Calvinism has, to answer your question, it's had some serious trouble with big name leaders, even the faith. Darren Patrick, shot himself. Mark Driscoll and James McDonald had, in different ways, left their mega churches, and others. So it's the next few years aren't going to be the same as the last 10 years. Let me put it that way. Mm-hmm. There's always churn. There's always change. There's always transition. And I think American evangelicalism is very much still in that process of transitioning and changing. And so is the new Calvinism.
Yeah. Did you get any pushback from the new Calvinist about including Mark Driscoll and Mars Hill in your book, given that that was one of the big scandals?
I did, yeah. And again, I thought it was only fair and true to reality to leave him in.
Yeah, I agree.
How big he was in, you know, 2007, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. It's just, you can't ignore him. He was a big voice in the movement, and to take him out would have felt disingenuous on my part, so I left him in.
No, I mean, I thought it was really, he was like so important and such a big celebrity. And what really, I mean, when he was at his peak, I mean, he was really, really, really a big name. How's been the reception of the book overall? How do you feel about that?
I mean, so it's just getting started. It just came out 2 or 3 months ago. I did listen to the podcast you were mentioning earlier, where Tim Keller basically said, you know, he thought the book was fair and accurate. I should say, I mean, I say a lot of these things, you know, boundary drawing and strategic actions and all these things, and it can sound like these are sinister actors, but I'm just trying to be a sociologist and say what I see. So I'm, as a Christian, I'm, you know, sympathetic with a lot of, you know, the ideas they put forward. I'm a traditional Christian, so it's not like I'm saying these are all terrible people or whatever, but I saw it and I had to say it the way I saw it. There's boundary drawing, there's strategic action, there's maneuvering, there's all this stuff, there's gatekeeping. And so thought I should mention that. But so Tim Keller has read it and he mentioned it on a podcast. It got a review in the Gospel Coalition. So, but it's just getting started in terms of public reception. I know there's some reviews coming, in other places, but
yeah, you got a great review in the Gospel Coalition, I think was basically that. And you know, I thought it was a very fair, you know, book. And again, I think some of those things like gatekeeping, they're integral to your theory, the strategic action field theory, but they're also just true. I mean, it's very obvious that that's what, you know, kind of what they're.
My book can come across as highly critical of lots of things, but I'm just trying to describe things the way I see them as, you know, reflecting social reality. So,
yeah, I think so often with these kind of intramural evangelical debates, everything sort of has to be filtered through some sort of a theological lens. So you write an op-ed or something kind of critiquing the other guy, you have to somehow make it like a Bible thing or make it in that. And so there's not a lot of people taking a step back and really doing, you know, true sort of cultural diagnostics, social diagnostics in a way that you do, where you're not, you know, you're not putting any religious hat on when you read it. You're strictly doing a scholarly analysis of it. I think that's very, very, very powerful.
Yeah. And I feel like I mean, I feel like I can think of other people who, if they had written on this topic, the book would have read differently. I think I would have been strongly more critical of the new Calvinist movement than mine is. I mean, I do talk about the, you know, all these things like gatekeeping and boundary drawing and stuff, but I mean, it's, I think overall it's, I tried to be fair, and I mean, you would have had people attacking them on sexuality and gender stuff that I don't, for example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I did have one question from somebody in the audience, and I'm not sure if I fully understand this, but if you have any thoughts on it, you can share, you know, if you, it's like, would you agree that the new Calvinists are more worried today about gatekeeping at the right side of the evangelical tent?
So when I was working on the book back in, say, 2011, 12, 13, 14, there was a big focus on gatekeeping to the left, right? So you have Rob Bell and the hell issue. You have World Vision and their thing on gay marriage. You have open theism, the idea that God doesn't know the future or knows the future as an unsettled possibility, you know, unsettled possibilities. And a lot of gatekeeping to the left. And there may, should I read the question? Yeah, so I think you might see a little bit more now of kind of boundary drawing to the right as well. So in the book, one thing I get into is a strong Trumpist version of American Protestantism. They're trying to draw some, you know, boundaries there, saying that's not really what we're about. So, and I'm not sure what else I can think of boundary drawing to the right.
One example I think is clear. I mean, you're seeing more and more people who are, for example, attacking complementarianism from the right. So there's a lot of kind of neo-patriarchy people out there that would be an example of someone coming in from the right. So complementarianism, I think, is a good example of a doctrine that's under attack from both sides. You know, so I don't know that they're per se gatekeeping that out, but it's something that's out there. There are more attacks from the right now, I would say.
So the question, I don't really see the new Calvinism drawing boundaries against the right as much as I see critiques coming from the right toward the new Calvinism about, so the distinction between patriarchy and complementarianism, for example, social justice and identity politics has become huge in the last couple of years in terms of being woke or whatever, and people saying that certain new Calvinist actors or organizations have gone too far into being sympathetic with identity politics or whatever you want to call it. So that's probably the biggest one, right? That big critique. So that is a factor. So unfortunately in the book, I don't really get into the identity politics, intersectionality, critical race theory, woke, whatever you want to call it. That the book was already pretty much, you know, at the publisher getting reviewed by the time this stuff really took off.
Yeah, I mean, that really came out within the last 5 years. You know, I mean, especially in the last 3 years, it's really accelerated.
Yeah, if I were to, you know, write it, you know, like do an update or whatever, I would need to include that for sure.
Mm-hmm. And then I guess the last question, again, a future-oriented question. You know, what is sort of the prognosis for new Calvinism? Maybe not in the immediate future, but a lot of the key big names that are left, like Keller and Piper, are retirement age. They technically retired from their pulpits. You know, John MacArthur is not going to be around. A lot of these guys are not going to be around. And when the main, you know, kind of when the main stage sage celebrities exit, is this thing going to have staying power, do you think?
As a thing, as an identifiable movement, I don't think we're going to be talking about it much more in 10 years. There's still going to be complementarian, socially conservative Calvinists around in 10 years and much longer after that. But I think the label New Calvinism or YRR, Young Restless Reformed, or whatever you want to call this cluster of actors, I think has already become less important than it was 5 years ago and will continue to become less important, which is not to say that, like I said, these religious convictions are going to, you know, recede to oblivion or something. Mm-hmm. So I think it is. I mean, I've never been to seminary, and I'm not big in the seminary world, so I don't know who kind of the people in their 30s coming up are would be. Who could kind of fill the shoes of a John Piper or a Mark Driscoll or Tim Keller or something, be a leader of a big mega church or something. Maybe they're out there. I mean, I don't pay as close of attention to the evangelical field anymore as I did when I was working on this project. But I don't know who the people are finishing their seminary degrees, MDivs or doctorates, but maybe they're out there. I know, I mean, people like Owen Strahan, for example, are, you know, very visible, but I mean, he's gone more in a John MacArthur direction than a Matt Chandler direction, if you know what I mean, mm-hmm. in terms of culture and stuff like that, social justice. I don't know who, so he'd be kind of the younger version, I think, of a John MacArthur, but I don't know mm-hmm. who the younger version of a Matt Chandler would be. I don't know.
Matt's still pretty young. I mean, I do think a lot of the younger guys, like, I kind of a little bit personally distinguish between people like Keller and Piper, who are a little more intellectual in their approach, with some of these more, like, Chandler to me is and Driscoll were more charismatic. They were sort of charismatic front men. I think there's always kind of a new young, up-and-coming young charismatic megachurch people who kind of catch fire. I think to me, the real question is, you know, whether it be like, where's the next intellectual generation going to be? I think Owen Strahan is a good, a good one to throw out there. It'll be interesting to see what happens. I think evangelicalism, New Calvinism, much like the political parties, is kind of in a state of flux, where there's a lot of forces coming, and we don't know exactly what it's going to look like. But it's going to provide sociologists. It's going to provide a lot of new dissertation material. For new young PhDs out there someday.
Yeah. And I mean, a lot of the, like I've mentioned a couple times, the mainstream of American evangelicalism is not Calvinist. I mean, there's a lot more, like there's over 1,000 evangelical megachurches in the country. There's Assemblies of God megachurches. You know, there's non-denominational megachurches that are not Calvinistic. You have the husband and wife, lead pastor, duo type megachurch. And so it's, there's a lot going on in American evangelicalism that's not complementarian Calvinist. And so you have to keep an eye on that too and see what's, because you're going to have big people coming up in the Assemblies of God world that a lot of people will never hear of or something, but they'll be right. Big in their own small world. So, but if we're just talking Calvinists, complementarian conservative Calvinists, then yeah, there's kind of that its own minority of American evangelicalism to keep an eye on. But it is a very visible minority. That's the whole idea of a reform resurgence, is that it's not always about the numbers that in the last 20 years that Calvinists have, like Keller said in his podcast, it's not like they've doubled and then tripled and quadrupled or something. It's more of a visibility thing and being on people's radar and publishing books that get read and hosting conferences and all sorts of more qualitative dynamics, not just the numerical increase to pay attention to. That's one of the main arguments of my book, is that while there has been a numerical increase in Calvinism since the turn of the millennium, which it's hard to pin down, the more powerful and important dynamics are these non-numerical ones that involve, you know, gatekeeping, boundary drawing, moving into cities, talking a certain way about sex and gender, which is important for younger evangelicals, and a few other things that are strategic and intentional and gain a hearing among a certain segment of evangelicals.
Right. Well, there's people should buy your book so that they can read about all that. I mentioned a few of the things in it, but you had like 12 or 14 different points of strategic actions and ways these guys have done it. And again, it's really a great book. Thanks for so much for joining me today to talk about it. Again, if you are in a kind of a Calvinist church, a Reformed church, if you're interested in this movement at all, it's a must read. Again, the title is Reformed Resurgence, the New Calvinist Movement and the Battle Over American Evangelicalism. by Brad Vermerland, Oxford University Press, available wherever fine books are sold. And again, if you haven't yet, hit the subscribe button on YouTube and get on the channel here. So, Brad, I appreciate you joining. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Glad to join you and talk about it.